morning. On behalf of the court, we want to welcome this morning a group of students from Lincoln High School of Wisconsin Rapids. They are here with the Court with Class program, which has won two national awards. Would the Lincoln High School students please stand? Welcome. Please be seated. And now that we have met you, I would like to introduce the court to you. Starting on my far left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his right is Justice Jeanine Jeske. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right, Justice John Wilcox. And on the far right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The students have received a synopsis of the cases and that will be heard today, and they will meet with Justice Crooks along with other students from Lincoln High School at noon or whenever we finish these arguments. With those introductions accomplished, we'll turn to our first case, 95-2928, Cadgey versus Chambers and Owen, Inc. Representing the plaintiff, Mr. Cadgey, is Richard Grant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I am attorney Richard Grant of Concini, Andrews, Hemming & Grant of Janesville, Wisconsin. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Wayne Cadgey, who is seated behind me. Wayne is here this morning to ask the court to take a serious look at the issues decided by the appeals court. On April 5, 1993, Wayne was terminated for refusing Chambers and Owens' demand that he sign a restrictive covenant. Wayne claims that the non-disclosure covenant violates not one, but several fundamental and well-defined public policies evidenced by Wisconsin Statute 103.465, especially as explained in the Van Zeelen case. He claims this is a wrongful discharge breach of his at-will employment contract, therefore a contract claim. Wayne's wrongful discharge claim was dismissed by the trial court. Wayne also claims that he was deceived and misled by Chambers and Owens' representations into delaying the signing of the restrictive covenant. That delay was then used to terminate his 12-year employment. That misrepresentation claim is a tort. That tort was tried to a 12-person jury, and the jury found that misrepresentation did occur. Perhaps the most important request I make of you today, beyond all the briefing, is to decide Wayne Cadgey's wrongful discharge contract claim under wrongful discharge contract law, and to decide Wayne Cadgey's misrepresentation tort claim under misrepresentation tort law. We complain here in large part about the improper mixing up of these two separate claims and the law applying to each. First, I would briefly comment about the claim I always believed was the easiest, the wrongful discharge claim. Under the dictates of Brockmeyer, especially as explained in the similar analysis of Laundry, Wayne Cadgey was clearly commanded to sign a restrictive covenant, refused, and was fired for that refusing. Equally as clear, an employer's imposition of a restrictive covenant on an employee is addressed in Wisconsin Statute 103.465. If Chambers and Owens' request and its non-disclosure paragraph violate a fundamental and well-defined public policy evidenced by 103.465, Wayne Cadgey was wrongfully discharged. Chambers and Owens' non-disclosure covenant is forever and worldwide. It is also very broad in its terms.
Counsel, just on the, when I look at 103.465, the key words seem to be only if reasonably necessary. Now, understanding the business that your client was in, employed by Chambers and Owens, And this was a contract, if I read it correctly, non-compete for 6 months, non-disclosure for 6 months. Now, what? That's wrong?
That's wrong.
Okay.
The 6 month is in a second paragraph, paragraph two.
The forever part you're talking about
is in the non-disclosure paragraph.
And that's what you find particularly offensive.
Correct. That's our focus and was the basis of the trial or of the cause of action.
Well, could you repeat that again, what you find particularly offensive?
Paragraph one of the management agreement, which is the non-disclosure paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
The 6 months provision applies only in paragraph two, which is, I believe, labeled the non-compete paragraph. But under the Van Zeelen case, the non-disclosure paragraphs are also very restricting in the restrictive covenant sense under the statute.
Mr. Grant, your client had signed a previous non-compete agreement. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
How did that differ from this particular agreement?
It differed most significantly in the fact that that agreement covered a specific employment that he had prior to 1991. Actually mentioned the actual functions that it applied to. In effect, it was testified to at trial and stated, I think, in the affidavits on summary judgment that that agreement did not apply, and that's why they were asking him to sign another one, because he changed his employment to equipment sales in 1991.
Were the territorial and geographic limitations the same in both of these agreements?
I believe so. There were none in the non-disclosure paragraph. And there were the 6 months and other provisions in the non-compete paragraph.
At trial, what excuse did your client give for not executing the second agreement?
Well, at trial, the wrongful discharge case wasn't tried. But, of course, there was testimony that he did not sign the second agreement because of representations made to him by the president and vice president of Chambers and Owen that nothing would happen to him and that the decision about signing the agreement wouldn't be finalized until the problems that he had with the changes in his employment were dealt with.
Well, what is the unreasonable restriction that you particularly take offense at?
The unreasonable restrictions are that in the non-disclosure paragraph, just as in Van Zeelen, and also in the Nalco case, there were no time and geographic limitations whatsoever. The disclosure of information was prevented forever and worldwide. And the same analysis in Van Zeelen we urge the court to apply to this case, that is, each separate paragraph must stand the public policy and the determinations under 103.465.
And then in the second paragraph, you also take offense at what?
No, we do not complain of that paragraph.
So essentially, if we ever reach the issue, and I assume we do not have to reach it if we should decide that the policy... that there is, that 103.465 ends it all. But assuming that we reach it, then you say that that is the only exception that you take to this non-compete and non-disclosure.
Well, it's the one that we principally addressed in our motion for summary judgment, which I'm asking this court to grant as to liability. I believe the paragraph, the geographic and time limitations, as the court knows, aren't the only restrictions that must be examined. Even on the non-compete paragraph, there are some broad terms in that agreement which could be examined by the court if paragraph one of the management agreement wasn't determinative. But since paragraph one is very much the same as in Van Zeelen, where there was no time and no territory restriction, and given the terminology of 103.465, we think that that paragraph is determinative. We believe that this court in its Van Zeelen and Strafe decisions point to at least 8 fundamental and well-defined public policies under 103.465. The public policy against unreasonable restraint of an employee's rights to engage in trade, public policy against restraints imposed by unequal bargaining power, the public policy against unknowing loss of livelihood, the public policy against protectionist restraint without corresponding benefit to the public, the public policy against protecting employer material generated only in the ordinary course of business, the public policy favoring unrestrained employment competition for the benefit of the consumer and society, the public policy against trade restraint unless absolutely necessary to afford reasonable employer protection, and finally, the public policy against overbalancing the employee's personal liberty interest in unfettered employment.
Mr. Grant, how do you answer the position that public policy is indeed set forth in 103.465, but the public policy that's enunciated is that if the agreement is unreasonable, that it's void and unenforceable?
That is answered in several cases, most recently the Hausman case, that it is no remedy to the employee for his wrongful discharge to make an attack on the employer, or even in the case of...
Well, isn't Hausman somewhat different in that Hausman involved an affirmative duty embodied in statute to make a report? Isn't that a very different situation from what we have here?
Right, but we're talking about what difference does it make that Wayne Taggi could, after he's terminated, sue the employer to void the agreement. That still leaves him without a remedy for the wrongful discharge. The one issue in Hausman that I think applies to this case is the court very clearly pointed out that where there is no remedy for the employee's wrongful discharge, the fact that some action can be pursued against the employer does not address or redress the wrong done to the employee. This is also stated, I found on review in the Brockmeyer case, I believe at page 840 of the Northwest site, that it doesn't give a remedy for wrongful discharge to the employee to say that you can take action against the employer for some wrong that the employer did.
Well, now, under the statute relating to the restrictive covenant, that only says the restrictive covenant is not enforceable. Does it give your client damages?
No.
So, under the wrongful discharge, what's your client, if you succeed, what's your client's remedy?
Under wrongful discharge, back pay and reinstatement. And it's important to note that 103.465 prohibits not only the enforcement of an illegal restrictive covenant, but the imposition of that illegal restrictive covenant, which is at the time that he signs it. Chambers and Owens' nondisclosure paragraph, I believe, offends all eight of the public policies I just recounted to you. The pervasiveness of paragraph 1 language, along with its forever and worldwide nature, clearly and seriously violate the Brockmeyer-Wandry standards. This
also,
is especially...
If arguably it violates public policy, where do you get the command, then, that Bushko speaks of from an employer mandating a breaking of that public policy?
Right.
Where do you get the affirmative legal command as in Hausman? I mean, you address Hausman vis-a-vis damages, but before you get damages, you need to maintain the cause of action. Where do you get the command aspect as our law currently requires?
Your Honor, that is probably one of the clearest things about this case, because not only was my client told verbally, but that verbal command was reiterated in a letter on the same day he was terminated, April 5, 1993, where it said, point blank, we demanded that you sign the non-compete agreement. You refused to sign it or failed to sign it, and therefore you are terminated.
Isn't the record ambiguous at that? In my recollection, there's another area in the record where the president was much more laissez-faire. Well, you don't have to sign it if you don't want to. It seems like...
But that goes to the misrepresentation as to whether right then he was misled as to whether he had to sign it by the 5th of April or not, when the president of the company was telling him that six or seven topics were going to be addressed.
It may go to misrepresentation, but it seems to me that it also goes to the existence. You're suggesting that the record supports the existence of a command, and I'm asserting that maybe the record is ambiguous about that. You don't see any ambiguity in the record.
No, because I think on April 5th, the employer has always contended that on April 5th, the command came to be, and they, according to their interpretation, despite the promises to address and change certain things about the terminology of the agreement, that command was refused, and that was the stated in writing reason by the employer for termination.
Mr. Grant, let us assume that the employer believes in good faith that the non-compete, non-disclosure agreement is appropriate under law, and the employee believes it is inappropriate under law, and therefore the employee says, I won't sign that. What is the employer supposed to do under those circumstances?
The employer bears that burden under 103.465. 103.465 came to be to address the issue of who was going to bear the responsibility for being wrong in this situation. Previously, under the blue pencil standard, the court was changing or altering the provisions of a non-compete agreement that were violative of the employee's rights to end up with some language that the court felt comfortable with.
So are you saying that the employer has to either keep the person on and no agreement, or fire the person and take a chance that by firing him, it may be an unlawful discharge if he's sued? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I believe that the statute and the public policy as addressed by the court in its decisions put that burden on the employer, and that since they have, under the canons of construction and under the five-prong test, long established in Wisconsin for validity of restrictive covenant agreements, I think that burden is squarely placed on the employer.
Well, how would an employer determine, other than firing the employee, whether or not his restrictive covenant, I mean, after all, the law says restrictive covenants are okay. Now, how is an employer going to determine if they're okay, if it's okay, the one that he's got, except by playing sort of Russian roulette and firing the person? Can you go to court for a declaratory judgment, or what? What's the practical? I mean, we've got to deal with some practicalities here, too.
A declaratory judgment would be one way, but I don't think that the law as it presently exists is quite that vague. I think, but I guess my point, what always impressed me about this situation is that the non-disclosure paragraph was so clearly violative of the policies and statements in 103.465, and it so closely paralleled the Van Zeelen case that the employer is certainly deemed to know that this particular non-disclosure paragraph violates the law. If it's a closer question, I think, yes, it may be a tough situation and a tough choice for the employer to make, but I think that the employer has that burden because they have all of the power under the law.
Let me ask you, respondent argues in response to what you just said that the non-disclosure clause is clearly violative of 103.465. And respondent's argument to that is that 103.465 doesn't apply, isn't a non-disclosure provision, it's a non-compete provision. And that if you're just attacking the non-disclosure part of the contract, that 103.465 is not invoked. I'll follow up with that second part of that question. I understand your argument is that Van Zeelen pulls it back into play, and their response to that is, well, Van Zeelen, first of all, it's picked up, but they also argue that 134.90, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, was enacted after Van Zeelen. So I'd like you to respond to sort of that packet of arguments that respondent argues in its brief.
Well, I think that the statutory language is quite clear that either imposing this type of restriction or attempting to enforce it is covered.
Well, what in the language of the statute covers the non-disclosure as opposed to the non-compete?
That's exactly what Van Zeeland explains, is that...
There's nothing in the statute itself that talks about non-disclosure, is there?
Oh, I think so. I think it's restrictive. It isn't... I think it's impossible
to... Point to me the statutory language you're referring to.
First of all, the title of the statute is Restrictive Covenants. And where you have a
that's
covenant.
Not an element. You know, the titles are not necessarily elements. I'm not trying to trick you up. I just want to see if there's language in here. I understand your argument that Van Zeeland perhaps expanded the statute or says that, but I want to know if there's anything specifically in the statute that deals with the non-disclosure.
They are prohibited if they are imposed and are not reasonably necessary for the protection of an employer as to the unreasonable restraint. The unreasonable restraint is a restraint upon the employee's ability to freely trade in the market as an employee. And what this non-disclosure paragraph does, just as explained in Van Zeeland, is it says that if you can't reveal any information that includes, as far as I can tell, almost everything you'd run into as an employee to anybody without any time limitation or any geographic limitation, you are indeed restrictively restrained in your ability to go out and be an employee in the workforce.
Well, if you look at, this is the argument, you look at customer data, so you think that the employee should at some time beyond the six-month period be able to disclose the customer data to Chambers and Owen, and that was unreasonable, right? In other words, that's what you're finding is restrictive under 103465. That seems to be the argument that I just...
Well, it's all of the information described in the language of paragraph 1. But remember, the test under 103.465 isn't that certain parts of it would be appropriate to protect the employer. The question is, are there any parts that are not appropriate? And since there is no time or geographic limitation, that's one way to find, yes, there are parts that are inappropriate and illegal under 103.465. Therefore, under the exact terms of that statute, the whole provision is voided. The whole provision is illegal.
Would you address 13490, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, and whether that has any implications?
The Uniform Trade Secrets Act, first of all, Van Zeeland is a very good example. It explains why a similar paragraph would not be covered by the trade secrets concept, which is largely...
Van Zeeland predates this section, is that right?
Right. Okay. Which was largely adopted in the statutes. If the court doesn't determine, as the Van Zeeland court did, that this is not a trade secret, that the information discussed in the paragraph 1 isn't a trade secret, even the respondent argues that this then becomes a factual determination that would have to be made by a fact finder. And in fact, we've placed those issues in evidence by Mike Roberts, an expert witness's testimony, and also by the affidavits filed by Wayne Tadgett. It's my contention that if the information contained in paragraph 1 is a trade secret, then virtually anything is a trade secret, and therefore you don't need restrictive covenants. You could just take the trade secrets law and say, now, employees, here's what the trade secret law says, and you can be sued, you can be restrained if you reveal any of this type of information.
So what, in your opinion, would have been a valid first paragraph? Would it have been 10 years? Would it have been 5 years? Would it have been 3 years? What, when we set a public policy, what are you looking for?
It must be, as the case law makes clear, reasonable as to time, reasonable as to geography, but also necessary in the first place. Usually, two. My experience with these clauses is that 2 years or less, you're depending on the facts again, because you always have to look at the facts of the individual case. But depending on the circumstances, 2 years or less normally is something that at least you're in the ball game.
And that's why when you ask for a, you know, the public policy, I think it's difficult to define exactly what the public policy would be if we have to look if they're so factually driven. In some cases, maybe it'll be 3 years. In some, it might be seven. It depends on the industry and the operation and the confidentiality and all of these other things.
That could be, but where it says forever and worldwide, I believe the ruling of Van Zeeland is that won't work, that on its face violates the public policy.
What is the ruling of Van Zeeland? I thought the ruling of Van Zeeland is that customer lists aren't trade secrets.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I thought the ruling of Van Zeeland was that customer lists aren't trade secrets.
Correct.
Yeah.
And
you just said something else was the ruling of Van Zeeland, and I didn't get that.
Well, what Van Zeeland, the language of the non-disclosure clause in Van Zeeland said that you may not reveal this information.
You may not reveal this information, so this follows up Justice Jeske's comment, for purposes of competing. In Van Zeeland, the person took the customer list for purposes of competing. And we have in your management agreement in paragraph 1 a non-disclosure, which you say is forever. But standing by itself, I don't know what the problem is unless it involves non-compete, which is the subject of the statute. Disclosure isn't the subject of the statute, it seems to me, but only as disclosure deals with competing.
Well, paragraph 1 introduces itself by saying the employee shall represent, work, and devote his or her efforts exclusively to representing the employer. Employees shall not offer for sale or encourage any person to purchase any product sold by a competitor of the employer, whether or not the employer sells such product. Then it recites the non-disclosure language, which I believe that precatory or introductory language is concerned with, which is the idea of not revealing it to someone against whom we compete.
I thank you, Mr. Grant. Your time is up. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Mr. Gantz, you represent Chambers and Owens.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Fred Gantz of Quarles and Brady. With me at the council table is my colleague, Laurie Morris, who worked with me on the brief. We represent the respondent, Chambers and Owen Inc., a privately held wholesale distribution company which markets primarily to the convenience store industry.
John Owen is the president, and Paul Owen
is the vice president. They're both here today, sitting to my right. Your Honor, in our judgment, this case centers on two issues. The first issue involves a claim for wrongful discharge, and the second issue involves a claim for negligent misrepresentation. I will address the wrongful discharge issue first. I would like to request permission of the Chief Justice to cite an additional reference not contained in our brief, that is Hale versus Stoughton Hospital at 126 West 2nd, 267, 376 Northwest 2nd, 89, Court of Appeals decision of 1985.
Published?
It's a published decision, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Have you given that citation to opposing counsel?
I have a letter in which I'd be happy to do that right now.
All right. You may proceed. Why didn't you cite it earlier, Mr. Gantz?
Well, Your Honor, Hale is a case, the particular issue that the court was speaking to, Hale is primarily a case that concerns a contract claim based on bylaws. And the particular portion of the case that I found interesting in preparing for oral argument had to do with a bad faith claim that was brought within Hale also, that the Court of Appeals pretty promptly rejected. It certainly isn't a case that's absolutely essential to our argument, but I did think it had some helpful language in it that I wish to refer to in the misrepresentation, with respect to the misrepresentation issue.
And you have no objection if opposing counsel, by letter, comments on the case?
None whatsoever, Your Honor. Taking into account, with respect to wrongful discharge, taking into account this court's analysis in the two most recent wrongful discharge cases, both decided in 1997, of Houseman and Kempfer, it is our position that the Court of Appeals decision in this case should be affirmed because Mr. Tadgey has failed to identify a fundamental and well-defined public policy sufficient to invoke Wisconsin's public policy exception to the employment at will doctrine.
I see the fundamental policy here, at least arguably, is that restrictive covenants are okay so long as they're not too restrictive.
That's one of the major reasons why, that is absolutely correct, Your Honor. And what you have in this, what you have in Section 103.465 is a statute that contains competing public policies. It is true that the statute prohibits employers from enforcing unreasonable non-compete agreements, but it is also true that this statute, as supported by the case law, recognizes that non-compete agreements are good for business to support the legitimate function of protecting an employer's confidential information and customer relationships developed at an employer's expense and entrusted to employees.
Mr. Gant, I'm going to ask the same question I asked Mr. Gant. You know I hear your name.
Sure.
But in a little bit different way.
Sure.
What if the employer drafts what the employer knows is an illegal restrictive covenant, and it won't pass muster, and he's told that by 10 attorneys. And he comes to the employee and says, sign this or be fired. Under the arguments you present, if he doesn't sign it, he can be fired and he has no recourse for back pay or reinstatement because he doesn't have a wrongful discharge case. Am I correct on that?
Well, if one were to take the specific facts as you presented to them, which are not the facts of this case,
I realize that.
That conceivably could be, what you have stated is true. However, I would urge the court not to adopt any type of rule that says that even if it's clearly unenforceable, a wrongful discharge claim is created. And there are several reasons why I would urge the court not to adopt a further exception. First of all, as this court has emphasized in its recent decisions and consistently since Brockmeyer, Brockmeyer provides for a narrow public policy exception. The only case that I am aware of dealing with this issue is one in Colorado, the Vasky versus Ducharme case cited in our brief. And it, quite frankly, Your Honor, contains a fact situation very similar to the one that you presented here, because in Colorado, as I understand it, this particular non-compete provision that was offered was totally void, was totally illegal, and in fact, the employer faced criminal penalties. And the Colorado Supreme Court found in that case, and I take it back, it wasn't the Colorado Supreme Court, it was a federal district court ruling on Colorado law, but they found in that case that a wrongful discharge claim should not be permitted because the real danger was to the employer with criminal penalties. If the employee signed the agreement, it was unenforceable. The point that I guess I'm making is that with respect to remedy, if an employee signs an unenforceable agreement, his remedy is that the agreement's unenforceable. There may be nothing that occurs later. He can continue working, a resolution can be reached later. And in particular, one of the things that I would point out when one looks at Section 103.465 is the public policy of this statute does not prohibit employers from requiring employees to sign non-compete agreements.
So the answer, I take it, Mr. Gantz, and
I mean, arguably it's a good answer, is that in faced with this kind of hypothetical situation, the only recourse for the employee is to sign it.
Sign the agreement, you continue to be employed, the agreement's unenforceable, and of course if the agreement is enforceable, which I realize is not the hypothetical you presented, then there's no violation of the public policy. The public policy of section 103.465 is that employers not be allowed to enforce an unreasonable provision. Now, if this court were to uphold Mr. Tadgey's claim for wrongful discharge in this case, this would make the employer's position under section 103.465 even more untenable. This is because, under Wisconsin law, an employer who fails to terminate an employee for not signing a non-compete agreement given to a group of employees risks having all of its non-compete agreements found to be wanting for lack of consideration. That was the holding in NBZ Inc. versus Pilarski, a court of appeals case decided in 1994 and cited in our brief. We also believe it is important to remember in this case that Mr. Tadgey's wrongful discharge claim clearly puts the proverbial cart before the horse. Unlike many of the cases cited in support of Mr. Tadgey's wrongful discharge claim, this case is not a non-compete case. If this court were to permit a wrongful discharge claim based on a refusal to sign a non-compete agreement to go forward, the trial court's analysis would have to focus on a hypothetical set of facts before an employer even sought to enforce the agreement. Mr. Tadgey's claim should not only fail as a matter of law, his claim also does not hold together under the facts, because the provision that he challenges is not a non-compete restriction, but rather only a non-disclosure clause. Paragraph 1 of the management agreement did not prohibit Mr. Tadgey from competing, but only required that he not disclose confidential business information without prior authorization. There was no restraint on trade. Mr. Tadgey's argument that the non-disclosure provision is void under section 103.465 relies on dicta from this court's decision in Van Zeelen. Van Zeelen was decided in 1978, 8 years before the effective date of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, section 130.90 of the Wisconsin statutes. Later decisions have clarified that unlike a covenant not to compete, a non-disclosure provision protecting arguably trade secret information need not have a specific time limitation. Also, a non-disclosure provision need not have a specific territorial limitation. This was also the holding of Malcolm and is also discussed in the Wisconsin Employment Law Treatise published by the State Bar at section 15.75, and which is also referred to in our brief. Furthermore, the trial court recognized the information Chambers sought to protect under its agreement is arguably entitled to trade secret protection. This information meets the statutory definition of a trade secret set forth in section 134.90 of the Wisconsin statutes. In short, under both the law and the facts, the Court of Appeals and the trial court's holdings that Mr. Tadgey has failed to state a wrongful discharge claim should be upheld. Now, with respect to negligent misrepresentation, which, as I stated at the outset, we regard as the second issue in this case, the Court of Appeals' decision affirming the dismissal of Mr. Tadgey's negligent misrepresentation claim should be upheld. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals correctly held that Mr. Tadgey's claim is really one for wrongful discharge and is not actionable by misrepresentation. This court held in Brockmeyer that wrongful discharge actions were most appropriately brought as contract actions, not as tort actions.
I'm sorry, Mr. Gantz, I'm really slow at the switch today. Can we stay on your last point?
Absolutely.
About this covenant not to compete. If this court should look at that, there's another way to look at it, and opposite of what you want, is that that first paragraph really does talk in general terms about competition. And therefore, even though it's not labeled covenant not to compete, nevertheless, it could be construed as such. If, in fact, that's how we decide, do you have a fallback position, i.e., that contrary to Mr. Grant's argument, that it is not specific as to geographic limitations and time, do you think it would still pass muster if we decide that paragraph 1 is, in fact, a covenant not to compete?
The answer is yes, Your Honor. And the reason why is because even if you were to find that it's a non-compete provision, the public policy of this state does not prohibit employers from requiring employees to sign non-compete agreements. The second answer is that the non-compete statute contains competing public policies.
But you understand, at least as I look at paragraph 1, it is not specific as to time and geographic limitations. It in effect covers the entire world ad infinitum.
I think that the proper interpretation is that a non-disclosure provision is lawful without a specific limitation because the prohibition against disclosure necessarily has an implied limitation. We refer you to NALCO, the Seventh Circuit decision applying Wisconsin law cited in our brief, and this court's decision as well in Minuteman versus Alexander, as discussed in our brief at page 27. It seems to me that what the courts have done in those situations, Your Honor, is stated that there is an implied time limitation, and so that when the non-disclosure provision is no longer needed, it expires automatically.
That would be contrary to the statute, though, which says you got to put it in and that there won't be implied. I thought you'd answer that you take the time and the geographical limitations of the second provision and read them into the first. That's what I thought you
Well, the trial court did that, and I think it is a very reasonable interpretation of the agreement, and it's also permitted under the Stripe case, as we talked, that you read provisions of the contract together.
Okay, on to negligent misrepresentation.
Sure.
On negligent misrepresentation, what duty does the employer have?
The employer does not have any duty independent of the performance of the contract. In Brockmeyer, the court held that wrongful discharge actions are most appropriately brought as contract actions, not as tort actions. The employment relationship is contractual. For there to be a tort, a duty must exist independently of the performance of the contract.
What about the general duty that you have to exercise reasonable care so that harm be avoided to others? I'm saying that loosely. What about that duty?
You're right. And Hales speaks to that. Hale talks about that and speaks to the fact that there is a general duty to use good faith within employment contracts. But this court has made very clear that it is not going to permit bad faith claims to be brought in Wisconsin. That to do so would subject each discharge to judicial incursion into the very amorphous concept of bad faith. As was stated in Brockmeyer, courts would become arbiters of any termination that may have a tinge of bad faith attached.
So you're relying on that good faith, bad faith discussion in Brockmeyer and kind of saying even if there is a duty, we can't open the doors to every concern of bad faith termination of an at-will employee. Is that your response?
That is absolutely correct. That's right. And it also should be remembered here, I think it's also important to emphasize that the employment relationship is a contractual relationship. And here, in this case, the jury found that there was no contract of employment. And As such, there is no independent duty that arises independent of the performance of the contract.
How is that possible? How is that possible? Of course, there's a contract of employment, and it may not be written. It may not even be formally stated, but there's an agreement that you do A, B, and C during the week, and I'm going to pay you X, Y, and Z, and you come here and you do that, and so there is an agreement.
Well, the question which the jury was presented here was whether there was any contract of ongoing employment.
Okay, but there is an agreement between two people, a person and an entity, that the corporation is hiring this person for an indefinite term to do tasks as assigned, and you do have a relationship. It might be a one-day relationship, it might be 10 years, but there is a relationship. And from that relationship, it would seem to me that there's a duty not to make misrepresentations. I mean, it's not like somebody is on the street and you don't know them and you negligently misrepresent that it's a safe passage or that you can traverse it or whatever. There's an ongoing relationship here, a kind of fiduciary relationship.
Well, Your Honor, Hales does not say that. The Hunter Court in California found the employment relationship to be a contractual relationship. The Conway Court in Oregon held that there is no special duty of care in an employment relationship. The concern that you have from the standpoint of the business community is that you're going to be opening the floodgates if you were to make such a ruling.
Floodgates of what?
Well, you're going to be subjecting virtually every discharge to judicial scrutiny.
Well, here, and we may have to go back to trial should you not prevail, the employee says he was told that he doesn't have to sign it, and he's not going to be punished. Now, if an employer says that, let us assume an employer says, I'd like you to do that, whatever it is. But if you decide you're not going to climb up the flagpole because you're afraid of heights, it's okay, we're not going to fire you. So if the guy says, I'm not climbing, and then they fire him because he didn't climb, you think that's right? Fair? Shouldn't be have a remedy under the law? Article 1, Section 9 says for every right there's a remedy,
yeah.
Every wrong there's a remedy, whichever.
Well, the argument that I would make, Your Honor, is that the employment relationship is contractual, and perhaps I didn't. What the jury question was there a contract of ongoing employment? Was there a contract that you were terminable only for cause? And the jury answered that question, no.
Okay.
Once they did, there's no independent duty. I also do want to respond to the point that you've asked and that Mr. Grant said with respect to nothing would happen. Nothing would happen. This is another try at an argument that was dismissed by the trial court. Nothing would happen was alleged as a specific allegation in this complaint. The trial court expressly held that this statement could not form the basis of a misrepresentation claim, finding that Mr. Tadji had been told before his termination that failure to sign the agreement would result in his termination. Mr. Tadji never appealed the trial court's ruling that any reliance by him on the alleged statement of nothing would happen to him was unreasonable.
So then you're finding that as a matter of fact, the trial court found this wasn't stated, so there was no negligent misrepresentation. That's a different argument than saying we can't do anything about negligent misrepresentation.
Well, it is a different argument, and I think it's an argument that is applicable to the facts of this case. But I am also concerned about an argument that would impose a negligent misrepresentation position on an employer in an at-will employment relationship.
Well, suppose the employer says there's no asbestos, just go ahead and work. And it turns out to be asbestos.
And that's a different situation, Your Honor.
Right.
That is a situation where I think a misrepresentation claim would be appropriate because it doesn't relate to the term of employment. That's the distinction. In other words, we are not stating that an employee can never bring a misrepresentation claim. If there were a claim about a misrepresentation of an existing fact, and the claim is unrelated to the term of employment.
Okay, the
yeah.
I
you might have a worker's comp
yeah.
situation then.
Right.
Well, that's true as well. Yes. Yeah. Get you back to the exclusive remedy issue
right.
that you've
yeah.
been dealing
but
with for a few years.
You can say, hey, I think it is asbestos. Everything about this looks like asbestos. I'm not going. And the employer says, okay, you're terminated. What do you think of that? And it turns out there is asbestos. Just to stack
yeah.
the deck.
The right. The again, that those are not the facts of this case.
I
and I do understand
that.
The court's concern about wanting to make sure that it would not do anything to encourage fraud. But with respect to employment, believe employment is a contractual relationship, and the analysis would come back to should typically be a contractual position. I do realize that the court may want to reserve or not consider the issue of fraud, because there is no issue of fraudulent misrepresentation in this case.
But the employer doesn't know, so he's negligent. He doesn't know if it's asbestos or not. He hasn't tested it. Just decides that we're going ahead. It's one day. It's cheaper. We're going to do it.
And under your facts, the situation...
The employee says, look,
yeah.
looks like, smells like, the time period for the building is right, it's asbestos, I'm not taking the chance, that's a life and death thing, you don't pay me enough to do that, I'm not doing it. And the employer says, you're fired.
Well, the concern I have is that in that situation, I could see many employees expressing a concern about asbestos and whatever, and I think the court could get into some fairly major analyses of whether it was reasonable to believe there was asbestos.
Doesn't that bring us back to the first issue of a wrongful termination contrary to public policy? And would that get back into your first issue, which is whether or not the employee was terminated contrary to public policy, if in fact the employee says, I'm not working here, there's asbestos here, and it turns out to be asbestos there. Would the issue be whether that was a wrongful termination?
That's right. In other words, that basically the issue again comes back to the court implying a provision as a matter of contract analysis that this violates some public duty, if there were a public duty in the statute with respect to that particular point raised by the Chief Justice.
It's your position then, following that discussion, that an employer does not have a duty to refrain from misrepresentation. Is that correct?
As a matter of law, I think that is correct, Your Honor. I think that when you start to impose duties upon employers to disclose all sorts of information or to look into all sorts of information related to the term of employment, you're going to be encouraging basically judicial scrutiny of virtually any discharge. That is a concern that we have, that it would unduly limit discretion of the employer. It would bring about increased judicial scrutiny.
An employer has no duty to tell the truth. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, as I say, not the facts here. And with respect to telling the truth, if it's a situation that's independent of the term of employment, then I believe an employer. We don't want to perpetrate any type of fraud upon an employee. On the other hand, I don't believe that an employer is always obligated to disclose a whole series of facts or virtually any question into which an employee may want an answer.
Mr. Gantz, it's not a matter of disclosing and the obligation to disclose. The question that we're dealing with here is there has been a disclosure, and does it have to be truthful? So you may omission to tell the truth is one thing, but when you actually say something, then there's the question is, do you have to tell the truth when you speak?
Well, I think you should tell the truth, and I think that there's absolutely no situation here in this record in which Chambers and Owen did not tell the truth.
But if the business doesn't tell the truth, you don't want them to be held liable for a misstatement, a negligent misstatement. That's your position.
My position is that if it's a situation that relates to the term of employment, that there are two things that I think are very important. First of all, that term is essentially contractual in nature. And secondly, that there is no special duty of an employer in the employer-employee relationship. We don't have a fiduciary duty. We certainly recognize that there's many situations in which torts can be brought within the employment relationship. We give several examples of them in our brief. But I do believe that where a jury found in this case that there was no contract of ongoing employment, no contract of employment terminable for cause, that there was no independent duty that arose separate from the performance of the contract.
Well, let me just do one more fact scenario.
Sure.
Let's have a fact scenario where an employee goes to an employer. It's an at-will relationship, and the employee says, "Look, I've got an opportunity at a great another job. I want to know whether there's going to be enough work here for me for the next year and a half because I really like what I'm doing, but I could earn much more money down there." And the employer says, "You'll be here for 2 or 3 more years." And 2 weeks later, the employee-at-will relationship is terminated. Your position is that there's no cause of action for that.
That is my position because the position is essentially a contractual position. Now, if you were extending that to, you know, if you're saying that you don't want an employer to be in a position to commit fraud upon the employee, I very much understand the concern of the court. This was solely a negligent misrepresentation claim here. But again, you get into questions about whether there was any justifiable reliance if indeed there was an at-will employment relationship. But I do respect the concern of the court in wanting to make sure that an employer doesn't perpetrate a fraud upon an employee.
Mr. Gans, can you give me an example of a duty that's independent of the performance of the contract? What do you think the court was talking about in Dvorak in this decision?
Well, the specific example used in Dvorak was of an insurer's duty to the insured. That would certainly be one situation in which there is an independent duty in addition to and outside the performance of the contract. Also, with respect to healthcare institutions, when a doctor is taking care of a patient, there's not only an employer-employee relationship between the hospital and that particular physician employed by the hospital, but there are also patient care issues that arise as well.
Mr. Gans, you have one more question, Justice
Babbage. Mr. Gans, you said a few moments ago that the judge had granted the motion to dismiss plaintiff's cause for negligent misrepresentation, but I didn't quite understand what you were saying with respect to his reasons. Now, I do know that the judge was asked a number of times prior to submission to the jury to dismiss, and the judge refused. He said this is a jury question. And then he allowed it to go to the jury, and the jury found negligent misrepresentation. Then motions after verdict, you again asked that it be granted, and the judge did. Did the judge give a reason? Did he grant it based as a matter of law that as you've just been arguing, it was a contract and the contract was out, or did he dismiss it on the grounds that as a matter of fact, the jury could not have concluded as it did?
My understanding is that the judge's ruling with respect to the negligent misrepresentation claims that went to the jury were twofold. First of all, that under Brockmeyer, wrongful discharge, the action is for termination in contract. And therefore, since the jury had found that there was no contract of employment, for ongoing employment or for employment terminable for cause, that resolved the issue, that wrongful discharge actions cannot be brought to tort. That was one ground. The second ground, upon a further discussion of the motion for reconsideration brought by Mr. Grant, was that there was no statement of fact that had been given to the jury, that all of the statements were about future events, opinions, and that there was no exception, there was no intent not to perform. And so for that ground as well, the negligent misrepresentation claim should be dismissed as a matter of law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Grant?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple brief comments. The argument that there is no harm in signing this agreement because your employment continues, I think very clearly violates the policy and the language of 103.465. I tried to make this real clear in the briefs that the statute doesn't just concern enforcing the point at which you would try to enforce the illegal agreement. It also says it shall not be imposed. And it's at the imposing level because that has a chilling effect on the employee as well. As soon as that agreement is imposed, it says I can't reveal any of this information. And that has a very chilling effect on the employee's ability to consider other employment, to do interviews for other employment, or in fashioning his options for the future. So I don't think it's just the enforcement angle. It is also the problem that once you impose this, you violate the public policy of 103.465. And I emphasize again that it is very important for the court not to consider this case under the idea...